You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesay from the History of the Second World War podcast. Join me on a journey through the most destructive conflict in human history, a journey that will take us not just through the famous campaigns and cataclysmic battles, but also to the lesser well-known corners of the war that touched millions all over the world, as we try and answer not just the questions of what and where, but how and why. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 40, Davison Pasha. Thanks for joining me. Last time, we talked a lot about 18th century European views towards what they referred to as the Orient, specifically Egypt. In this episode, we are going to flip perspectives and examine what these societies Napoleon was about to encounter were actually like. Hopefully, strip away some of those old Orientalist myths and take a look at the Napoleonic era Middle East as it actually was. Even some very good scholars of Napoleonic history struggle with this task. People who write about Napoleon tend to be specialists in European history, and so the Middle East is quite literally out of their area. I admit I'm no exception. Fortunately, I have a friend who has the knowledge we need to bridge the gap. His name is Derek Davison, and I've invited him to join us today. I told Derek he could write his own introduction. So here goes. Quote, Derek Davison is a writer and podcaster who spent a frankly ridiculous amount of time studying Middle Eastern history at the University of Chicago. Nowadays, his writing on history, U.S. foreign policy, and world affairs can be found at Loblog, and that's the way it was, and therila.com. He will never log off. End quote. Without further ado, here's my interview with Derek Davison. All right, Derek Davison, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk Egypt and the Middle East in the 18th century.
Okay, sure. Why not? It's Wednesday. That's a good day for Egypt in the 18th century.
Let's start with the absolute basics. You talk about Egypt in this era, the like almost interchangeable term is the Mamluks.
Right.
Who were the Mamluks?
So, unfortunately, even though Wednesday is the day for 18th century Egypt, we have to go back a lot further to talk about the Mamluks, because they were around as far back as the 13th century, and that's really where their origins are. The Mamluks were... The word Mamluk in Arabic means something that is owned or someone who is owned. So you can derive from that that they were slaves. They were slave soldiers specifically. There are a lot of words in Arabic for slave that all have kind of different connotations, but Mamluk was the one that was used for slave soldiers. These were initially Central Asian Turkic slaves who were brought into Egypt by the Fatimid Caliphate, which ruled from the 10th century to the end of the 12th century. And then after they were overthrown by Saladin, he founded the Ayyubid dynasty, the very short-lived Ayyubid dynasty, which ruled from the end of the 12th century to the middle of the 13th century. Both of these dynasties made a practice of bringing in slave soldiers, primarily out of a sense that they could be more easily controlled, that their loyalties would be with the Sultan or the Caliph, as the case may be, rather than with some other faction in society, and so they could be more reliable. As it turned out, that was not really the case in the long run. And what wound up happening was the Mamluks themselves, the actual slave soldiers, as they rose through the ranks to occupy higher and higher positions in the army, positions in the bureaucracy, they really amassed more functional power than the Ayyubid sultans, most of whom were not very effective rulers. In 1250, a Mamluk named Aybak became the de facto ruler of Egypt. They spent about another 10 years propping up Ayyubid kind of puppets before in 1260, just kind of shoving the dynasty out and ruling in their own right. What makes the Mamluks unique is that they're not a dynasty per se. There are other examples of slave soldiers kind of overthrowing their masters and establishing their own ruling families, but the Mamluks didn't really work that way. The Mamluk system operated on the basis of factions. So the Mamluks, you know, the Mamluks of a particular emir would kind of coalesce around one another, and they would support their boss, their leader, as he, you know, tried to work his way up the ladder and eventually maybe become sultan someday. And these factions were constantly kind of duking it out for primacy in the sultanate. You did have sultans who tried to leave the sultanate to their children. Occasionally this was successful. Oftentimes it was not. The children would rule as puppets for a little while, and then they'd be overthrown by new Mamluks. The idea was that you couldn't really participate in the Mamluk political system unless you had gone through this process of being purchased as a slave and brought to Egypt and kind of incorporated into a cohort and you know, risen through the ranks that way. So they're a unique dynasty. Well, I'm going to call them a dynasty. They're not really a dynasty. It's a unique system in Islamic history. And really, I mean, there are not a lot of examples of anything like this anywhere else in the world, to be totally honest. And so that's who the Mamluks were and where they came from. The Mamluks ruled Egypt from 1250 until 1517. They were then defeated. Egypt was conquered by the Ottomans. But the Mamluks didn't go away. The Ottomans left them more or less in place as a kind of military auxiliary and, you know, aristocracy, kind of inherent aristocracy. So they stayed there, and you know, we can talk about what happened between 1517 and Napoleon, but the upshot is by the time you get to 1798, they have once more kind of reasserted their control over Egypt, and Egypt has become a mostly autonomous place by that point.
So to underscore, end of the 18th century, the system really hasn't changed all that much since the Middle Ages. Still bringing in people from, I think by this point it's mostly like Circassians, people from the Caucasus.
Right, yes. At some point, while there's an initial period of Mamluk rule where it's mostly kind of Central Asian, Eurasian steppe Turks who are running the place, but they start to look elsewhere for their slaves. And as you say, they bring in a lot of Circassians. Eventually the Circassians rise up through the ranks and they become the dominant power in the state. By the end of the 18th century, it's expanded further, partly because of Ottoman connections. You have Albanians, other Balkan peoples being purchased and brought to Egypt. You have other Caucasian peoples, Georgians and I don't think Armenians, but definitely Georgians coming in and, you know, working their way through the ranks. So it's become even more kind of diverse.
Now, to the French, they looked at that system because this was known in the West. These people were slave soldiers from elsewhere. And so the French looked at this system and said, oh, these people are foreign tyrants ruling over the native population. Is that how things were perceived in Egypt, as these, you know, these people were outsiders, or had they kind of become part of the society?
No, they were very much outsiders. I think that you could say actually by this point they were probably considered even more outsiders than they had been, say, in the 13th century. Initially, the Mamluks were almost a heroic bunch. I mean, you can go to Cairo today in the Cairo Military Museum and see busts of, two of the first Mamluk rulers, Qutuz and Baibars, who were responsible for fending off the Mongols and making sure that the Mongols didn't conquer Egypt, and kind of preserving not just Egypt, but really Islam in a sense. You know, Egypt became a kind of repository for the faith after the Mongols conquered Baghdad. So, I mean, they were hailed as great heroes and defenders of Egypt and defenders of Islam. But they were outsiders, and they were particularly, they began to grate on people, especially in Cairo. So when we talk about what the Egyptian, kind of the Egyptians themselves thought about these guys, mostly what that means is what the people in Cairo, what Cairenes felt about them, because they're the ones who had to deal with them on a regular basis. And they grated on the Egyptians mostly because of this constant factional competition, which often spilled out into the streets, often turned violent, never rose to the level of like a full-on civil war. But particularly on the death of a sultan, but also, you know, other times if there were two factions that just didn't get along with each other, you would have Mamluks kind of riding through the streets of Cairo and bashing each other over the head, and, you know, regular citizens would get caught up in that and, you know, suffer property damage or worse as these guys kind of duked it out with one another. And that, as you can imagine, wasn't the kind of thing that people really appreciated. It compounded by the fact that these guys were not Arab. They were foreigners in the strictest sense. Many of them wouldn't have spoken Arabic. After the initial defense of Islam against the Mongols, these guys weren't terribly good Muslims. They weren't, on the whole, terribly pious. I mean, they drank, they fought, they killed other Muslims, which you're not supposed to do. So there was a lot to, I don't know, whatever the opposite of recommend them is. There was a lot for the people of Egypt to dislike. And when the Ottomans came in the 16th century, for a period of time, maybe for the most of the rest of the 16th century, there was a strong, you know, relatively strong Ottoman presence. It diminished more and more as the century wore on, and then, you know, in the 17th and 18th centuries became almost non-existent. And I think the Ottomans tried to impose some order. They tried to calm things down. They tried to impose, in particular, some religious norms on on Egypt that maybe hadn't been there. And that taste of something a little more stable and calm, I think, was probably something that Egyptians, and again, particularly Cairenes, appreciated. And so when it went away, when it began to go away and returned to the kind of the bad old days of mobs and gangs of Mamluks riding through the city, smacking each other on the head, it was even more kind of intolerable for them because of that.
You know, something you just touched on, which, everything I've read about the Mamluks, a word that crops up over and over again is chaotic in describing their rule, with these factional infighting and the kind of no clear succession. And, they're often not described as very good rulers. And yet they held on for centuries. So what was the secret to the success?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the power of the system was such that nobody else could amass enough power. Like, even Arab elites, I mean, they were really locked out of the system by which you could accrue kind of enough military power to challenge these guys and potentially overthrow them. It was monopolized quite effectively among the Mamluks as a whole. Now, certainly they didn't get along with one another all the time, and they were fighting amongst one another. But there was no other group that had the space to kind of challenge them for primacy, or to say, you know, hey, let's overthrow these guys. I think a crucial sign that the Egyptian people weren't all that fond of the Mamluks is you don't hear about a lot of unrest after 1517, when the Ottomans take over Egypt. You don't hear a lot of rebellions or Arab elites rising up and saying, you know, hey, what happened? Let's bring the Mamluks back. They're more or less content to have the Ottomans come in and take over. And there's no real change in any kind of anybody's day-to-day existence. It's just they're, you know, kicking some taxes up to Constantinople or Istanbul now, instead of, you know, everything going to the support the Mamluks.
Mm. This is part of the Ottoman Empire, and you've mentioned a couple times that wasn't quite as cut and dry as it might seem when Napoleon arrived. So what was the degree of control that the Ottomans had in 1798?
By that point, it was pretty low. The Ottomans, when they came in, a couple of things happened that kind of made Egypt different from most other Ottoman conquests. When the Ottomans conquered places in their kind of core territory, so the Balkans or Anatolia, they moved in. One of the things they would do fairly early on was they would move in and kind of either brush aside or co-opt the local elites, and they would replace them with Ottoman elites, Ottoman nobles, who would be given land grants to administer, you know, portions of the territory and farm it for taxes, and you know, send those taxes to the central government. They didn't do that. I mean, that was very effective in sort of bringing these areas into the empire fully. They didn't do that in Egypt. I think they felt like Egypt was a special case. Certainly Egypt was really a special case. It was an established nation, more or less, you know, had been a nation for millennia by this point, really. And it had its own system, its own way of doing things that was heavily based on the Nile, you know, its own way of administering itself that was based on the peculiar needs and circumstances of Egypt. And it was such an important conquest for the Ottomans. It was the single most important conquest they ever made, at least from a kind of economic perspective, that I don't think they wanted to do anything that might upset, you know, kind of tip over the apple cart you know, ruin anything. So they just said, pretty much said, we're going to leave things more or less in place in terms of how this place is run. That's why the Mamluks didn't go away, because the Ottomans had no interest in kind of major upheaval there. At the end of the 16th century, the Ottomans went through a crisis. They fought what's known as the 13 Years' War with the Habsburgs. It didn't go terribly well for the Ottomans. They wound up arming their peasantry in the Balkans in order to fight, you know, in order to counter the Habsburgs. And as oppressed minority peasants might do, when the government suddenly hands them a firearm, many of them turned around and used it against the Ottomans. And there was a series of rebellions that are called the Jalali rebellions you know, the Ottomans had to put down. The end result of this was that the empire shifted really from an empire of conquest to an empire of more or less management and bureaucracy. There's a real change in the early 17th century that the Ottomans go through. And I think that also took some of the starch out of any plans they might have had long term to kind of more fully incorporate Egypt into the empire. There was just no impetus for that kind of thing, because they were struggling with their own problems, basically. Consequently, the Mamluks had a fairly free reign to do as they pleased. There was nominally an Ottoman governor who was supposed to be at the top of the hierarchy, but those governors didn't have a natural base of support in Egypt, and they were frequently kind of undercut by the Ottomans themselves, who feared any governor being in Egypt for too long and amassing too much support that they could become a real problem. So they would change these, they would swap these guys out fairly frequently, sometimes as on the order of one a year, even. And consequently, they were pretty weak, especially the longer, you know, this administration went on. So already by the end of the 16th century, you can start to see the Mamluks making a resurgence. By the end of the 18th century, I mean, they're just doing what they want. They're not following the Ottoman governor. They're basically ruling Egypt again themselves. There are two offices. They're not sultans anymore, but they have two offices. One's called the Sheikh al-Balad, or the chief of the city, who's kind of the recognized as the preeminent Mamluk. It's not an official office, but it's one that has more or less official trappings. You know, this whoever holds it is the ruler of the Mamluks,
and they're responsible for keeping tabs on the governor, right?
Right, right. Responsible for keeping tabs on the governor. Responsible basically for telling the governor to go when he was a problem. And the other office that was important was the Amir al-Hajj, which is the person who runs the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. That office took on a lot more responsibility. It became sort of the military leader of the Mamluks, kind of alongside, maybe a little bit underneath the Sheikh al-Balad, but they were more or less peer positions, and leading Mamluks would kind of swap back and forth between these two offices and to maintain their positions at the top of the heap. Those guys by the end of the 18th century were by far more powerful than whatever governor, whatever poor sad sack of a governor was sitting in Cairo kind of trying to pretend that he was in charge of Egypt. It was the Mamluks who were really running the show.
I mean, some of the sources, these Ottoman governors almost sound like they're like under house arrest.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fair thing to say. They were not free to operate as they wished. They were, some of them would even have their movements restricted. I mean, you know, it was not a job that anybody would have wanted to have, even though it sounds prestigious, like you're the Ottoman viceroy, basically. You're the Ottoman governor of this hugely important province that not only includes all the wealth of Egypt, but includes Mecca and Medina. You know, it's a tremendously important post on paper. And yet you go there and you find out that these kind of maniac horse riding goons are really in charge, and you kind of serve at their pleasure, basically. And quite literally, because there are examples of the Mamluks just up and murdering Ottoman governors, and nothing is done about it. Nothing could be done about it. There was no way to punish them for something like that.
Wow. But, you know, despite all this, Egypt had in recent history been a big economic powerhouse. Was that still the case in 98?
Yes. I mean, there was nothing about Egypt. In fact, the most of the 18th century for Egypt was a pretty good one, economically speaking. It was a period of, relative to the previous couple of centuries, a period of stability, kind of countrywide. That stability might not have been felt so much in Cairo. But on the whole, it was a relatively stable time for Egypt, and they still controlled. I mean, they still had the huge agricultural output of the Nile. They still sat on a very important trade route to the Indian Ocean and India. Ships would come up the Red Sea. Technically, the Ottomans required those ships to stop in Jeddah and then let Ottoman merchants take the cargo from there and take it to Suez, and from there it would go on to Europe, etc. But in reality, by this point, the Ottomans couldn't enforce that policy, so the Egyptians themselves were engaging in that trade again, and that meant a little extra kind of economic benefit coming out of that commerce.
Mm. So what was life like for, and we've talked a lot about the people who were on top, but obviously most Egyptians were poor farmers, the fellaheen. And then there's also, of course, you've already touched on a bit, average people in the towns. How did they live?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty standard kind of agrarian existence, I think, for most Egyptian peasants. And these people, if you weren't in Cairo, if you weren't subject to kind of the regular gang violence, you probably didn't pay a lot of attention to who was running the country. I mean, the sort of political details of who's preeminent and who isn't probably didn't make a lot of difference to you. The life of Egyptian peasants was much more dictated by what's the Nile doing this year than what anybody's doing in Cairo. In the cities, there were artisans, there were merchants, a lot of Arabs held these positions. There was a pretty thriving Arab elite in the cities, wealthy Arabs who were nevertheless locked out really of most possibilities of political advancement. Though that was the population, I would say, kind of upper middle class to upper class Arabs who Napoleon was trying to appeal to with his flyers and the propaganda that he rolled out. Again, I mean, this was for most people in the cities, you're just trying to eke out an existence. If you're not part of that economic elite, then you're trying to, sell your wares on the market and have enough money to feed your family and support your family. You wouldn't have spent a lot of time thinking about all these bigger political issues that are going on until, Mamluk rode down the street and smashed your shop because he was mad at some other Mamluk who was, at the other end of the block. Then you would be confronted by the fact that you're ruled by these kind of lawless foreign gangs that are really detrimental to your life in a material way.
Mm. Bit of a difficult topic here because when we talk about the Middle East, even today, Westerners oftentimes tend to focus overly much on religion, on Islam. But we're talking about an 18th century society, and religion was massively important. So what was the role of religion, particularly Islam, in Egyptian society?
It was big. Part of Egypt's national image, as far back, I keep going back to the 13th century, but as far back as that, and maybe even earlier, but certainly after the Mongols rolled through the rest of the Middle East and destroyed the Abbasid Caliphate and were really threatened Islam fundamentally. Egypt became the repository of Islam. The Abbasids, line of Abbasids moved to Cairo, and the Mamluks kind of set them up as more or less puppet caliphs. Nobody really believed that they were legitimate, but they pretended because it was easier. It was kind of a nice way of upholding the tradition of having a caliph. But Egypt was the place where Islam basically held the line against these animist or Christian. Some of them were Christian. I mean, the Mongols were a whole kind of mix of religions. So, it was where the Islam kind of drew the line and was protecting, it was protected within Egypt. So it was a big deal. I mean, that was a big fundamental part of Egypt's kind of view of itself. In 1517, when the Ottomans came in, they both kind of took away from that a little bit and added to it in the sense that They abolished the little kind of puppet Abbasid caliphate. Later on, they would claim that the caliphate actually now belonged to the Ottomans, which again was something nobody really bought, but they tried to use it anyway. But they also tried to impose some of the Ottoman Empire's religious bureaucracy on Egypt and kind of tighten things up a little bit, maybe more than they had been under the Mamluks. What really wound up happening, especially in the 17th century and into the 18th century, was there was a huge growth of Sufism, especially in the cities. Probably this had something to do with the loss of the caliphate, in the sense that that was something that people could kind of unify around. It was a symbolic thing that was gone now, and so people were looking for other religious outlets. And we do see a sharp kind of uptick in the number of Sufi orders, the number of Sufi lodges, kind of the overall development of Sufism in Egypt.
So, and just to explain for everyone, Sufism is like kind of a mystical, more I guess charismatic form of Islam.
Yeah, it depends on the Sufi order. Some of them are really quite orthodox. Some of them get really far out. Many of them incorporate some indigenous, even pre-Islamic beliefs or practices. There's a wide range of things. In general, yeah, it's a sort of mystical intellectual form of Islam that's dependent, very heavily dependent on a teacher-student relationship. So you have a Sufi sheikh or elder who kind of has his ideas about Islam, and he shares them with a trusted group of students who then go off and become teachers in their own right. And, you know, these orders propagate themselves that way. But it's a little more kind of engaged, a little more active than sort of the standard standard practices of Islam.
And it's more popular, right? Rather than official hierarchies, almost like Protestant versus Catholic in the West.
Yeah, I mean, it's the popular kind of expression of Islam at the street level in many places. Islam doesn't have a strong religious hierarchy, at least not Sunni Islam. It doesn't have a very strong religious hierarchy anyway, but Sufism is kind of the down and dirty. Everybody's, you know, kind of on the street level at the individual level.
Mm.
The other thing that Egypt had that was important from a religious perspective and important from a national kind of self-image perspective was it had Al-Azhar, which was and still is the preeminent place for Sunni legal and intellectual development. Al-Azhar is a mosque/university in Cairo. Was founded under the Fatimids, but it's been around ever since. And it's really after the fall of Baghdad, which obviously was kind of the capital of Sunni Islam when it was the capital of the caliphate. After Baghdad fell, Al-Azhar really became the place where if you were a leading scholar of Sunni Islam, if you were somebody who was a legal theorist or a religious kind of theologian, this was the place you wanted to go. This was the place where the really influential heavyweights in the scholarly community were at. And it was the place where if you needed a definitive ruling on something, you know, had a religious question, you needed it to be answered, this was the place that you would turn.
Mm. We're talking about, you know, the kind of stuff they were doing at Al-Azhar. You know, it's not just like theology, because law and to an extent even government are also based on, it's kind of all one thing, right?
Right. I mean, a lot of the work that would have been done at Al-Azhar would have been related to Sharia issuing rulings about, geez, what do I do if this happens? What's the religious thing to do? And you would appeal to the scholars. And if you were really, if you had the money and the power, you would appeal to the scholars at Al-Azhar because they were the best. to ask them, you know, what's the right thing to do? What would Muhammad have done, basically?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so it's all tied up together. It's not just kind of hashing out the intricacies of the faith. You're actually issuing legal rulings, fatwas, that have practical application to people's lives.
But of course, not everyone in Egypt was Muslim. There was and still is a very big Christian minority called the Copts. What was their status?
So the Copts were all the way back to the earliest Arab conquests of Egypt. Copts were very much involved in administering the province. In the early years, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the Arab conquests, the Arabs tended to leave the people who had been in local bureaucracies alone. They just had to change their allegiance from Constantinople to Medina, or from the Persian from Ctesiphon to Medina. But more or less, they left people in place who were already running those places. And then, you know, this sort of that turned into a kind of sense of inertia, even after the caliphate began to bureaucratize itself and standardize things and become a true kind of political empire. These people, you know, the same people who had been bureaucrats tended to remain in those positions. And for Egypt, that was the Copts. There was there's obviously pressure, not from any authorities, but just pressure if you wanted to reach kind of the heights of society. There was a lot of pressure to convert to Islam, and a lot of Copts did convert. But what we know of them, and there's not great records for the Copts. There's actually better records for Jews in Egypt at this time. But what we know of the Copts in this period, they still tended to be very important in administrating. You know, had important roles in administrative jobs, kind of filling up the ranks of the bureaucracy.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. So we've talked a little bit about Al-Azhar, which gets into my next question. What was intellectual life like? In particular, you know, in the West, big changes going on in this period with the Enlightenment. Was there anything comparable in Egypt, or are we still talking about, you know, things kind of being the way they had been?
Mostly you're talking about things being the way they had been. In fact, it's Napoleon showing up and bringing, you know, the French Revolution and the printing press in particular to the Middle East that kind of wakes everybody up to what's going on. And you see, you know, especially in the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, the story of the Ottoman Empire is about trying to capture whatever, you know, they wanted whatever Europe was having, basically. You know, they built new schools that were modeled on the European system. They brought in European advisors. They tried to reform their military along European lines. But that really kicks off with Napoleon's arrival. People were aware, especially people who were involved in commercial activities in Egypt at this time, were aware that there was something happening in Europe. And in the rest of the Ottoman Empire, they were aware of this too. The evidence was clear, if only because the Arabs, or the Ottomans, I guess, by this point, had started losing wars to the Europeans. I mean, that was the wake up call, really. Like, we used to kick these guys' asses on the regular, and we're not doing that anymore. So something must be different. But I don't think they had a really good handle on what that was. There wasn't a huge amount of contact on a kind of intellectual or even diplomatic level, prior really to Napoleon. We do see in the Ottoman Empire, Selim III comes to power earlier in the 18th century, and he does try to do some European style reform. So clearly there were people who understood that the Islamic world had been surpassed, that they, you know, the Europeans had caught up to them and moved beyond them, and they were trying to catch up. But on the whole, and especially in Egypt, which was sort of, more insular kind of place, the Mamluks were certainly not interested in what was going on outside their own world. There wasn't a lot of thought given to, you know, hey, what's happening in Europe, and should we be jumping on this? Napoleon's arrival was a huge wake-up call for the entire region, but for Egypt especially.
So what was the view, you know, when an Egyptian person thought of a Westerner and thought of the West, what did they think?
I mean, that's a good question. It would depend, I think, on what kind of Egyptian person you're talking about. You know, I would imagine the Mamluks didn't think too much about it. The Mamluks were never a real expansionist bunch, even when they were in power in their own right. You know, they dealt with the Crusaders. That was about it. You know, I think mostly you would have seen Westerners as traders in a commercial sense. These are the guys who come in and buy our stuff, or they buy the stuff that we've helpfully shipped from India. So, you know, not a terribly negative way to think about somebody, but sort of benign, I guess. You know, I don't think there was a sense that Europe, there wasn't a sense yet until Napoleon showed up, of a threat from Europe or anything like that. So I mean, my inclination would be to say, on the whole, your main impression of the Europeans would be, these are the guys we do business with.
Interesting. No lingering bitterness from that period of rivalry, you know, when the Ottomans were on the rise and the West was desperate to, find a place where they could hold them off.
The Ottomans certainly had more direct contact. I mean, I know that I'm kind of creating an artificial separation between Egypt and the Ottomans, because Egypt is technically Ottoman at this point. But Egypt was so autonomous and so much its own thing that I think you have to treat them not quite as separate entities, but you know, more or less as operating independently of one another. The Ottomans certainly, you know, they continued to make war against Russia, against the Habsburgs. They were constantly kind of having these issues in the Balkans. This isn't too far away from the rise of serious nationalist movements in the Balkans. So, certainly they were aware, you know, certainly their view of Europeans would have been colored by that. On the other hand, the Ottomans, you know, had a longstanding alliance with the French that was sort of upended actually when Napoleon invaded Egypt. Certainly for them, I think it was a more immediate kind of, they had more immediate contact with Europeans in a negative way. For people in Egypt, this wasn't, you know, really a thing that they dealt with very much. The Egyptians didn't usually fight in Ottoman wars because they were too far away. Their job was mainly to keep control of Egypt. There was a Janissary Corps in Egypt. One of the innovations that the Ottomans did manage to bring in with them was that they brought the Janissaries, who were the main kind of Ottoman infantry, the firearm, you know, the guys with the guns, basically, who won most of the Ottomans' wars for them. But the Janissary Corps that they brought to Egypt was very quickly kind of infiltrated by Mamluks and basically became another Mamluk institution. So, you know, it just wasn't something that people in Egypt would have had to engage with on a regular basis.
Of course, they certainly would have been aware, though, that Westerners are not Muslims. And what would have been the significance of that, of a big non-Muslim army showing up?
Yeah, I mean, they were aware of that, but there was also, I mean, when Napoleon showed up and he printed his pamphlets and in mangled Maltese Arabic, one of the things that he talked about was, aside from his BS about how, I really like Islam, actually, I've read the Quran and Muhammad was a good guy. Apart from that, one of his messages, which again, I think was really targeted at kind of Arab elites, was these Mamluk guys aren't really good Muslims either. They're interlopers. They're foreigners. They don't really practice the faith very well. So, I think the arrival of the French army would have been a little shocking to Egyptians because they were just not prepared to think that the Europeans were capable of something like that. But because there was a pretty strong disconnect by this point between the Mamluks and the people they were ostensibly ruling, I don't know that they would have given too much thought to the idea that this is a non-Muslim army invading Egypt. They were not happy with the Mamluks. They were very much not happy with the Mamluks. So, yeah, it probably caused a bit of a stir, but I don't think it was something that, I'm sure bothered some people, but I don't think it was a kind of major concern.
Interesting. The French were very worried about that, Napoleon in particular, about that barrier between cultural and religious between the French and the Egyptians. But it sounds like from what you're saying, people were pretty used to that.
Yeah, I mean, they were used to foreign domination. Egypt hadn't been ruled by anything that you could call, anybody you could call Egyptian since, I guess you could go back to the Fatimids, maybe, although they weren't even really Egyptian either. But it had been a long time. It had been a very long time since Egypt had kind of ruled itself in that sense. And it would be a long time. It would be all the way until the 20th century before you could really say it again. Mm. You don't get, at least my impression is, there's not a lot of popular support for the Mamluks when they're fighting, say, the Battle of the Pyramids or when Napoleon rolls into Cairo. You don't see the people kind of rushing out into the streets or signing up to serve in the Mamluk army to defend the Mamluks or to defend Egypt from these guys. It just sort of, it's an occupation and it just kind of happens.
So fair to say the French turned people against them rather than encountered people who were already kind of hostile to them?
I don't know about that. I think their messaging played well into the conception that people already had of the Mamluks. And again, I'm mostly talking about people who lived in Cairo and had to deal with their BS on a regular basis. For people in the countryside, again, even to have the French show up, even to have these Christian French show up or these atheist French, whatever you want to call them, show up, is like, how does this affect my day-to-day existence? I'm just growing my crops. I'm trying to make sure that I don't die tomorrow and my kids have enough to eat. This doesn't really matter to me on a serious level. I think it was, it wasn't something that consumed anybody in that sense.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned a bit earlier Yet the Ottomans historically had been allied with the French. What was the international situation? Where did the Ottomans fit in to the great power system of this era?
This is, I mean, you're very close to sick man of Europe status at this point. They're definitely on the defensive. The high watermark of the Ottoman Empire is typically thought to be their last siege of Vienna, which was in the late 17th century and was a dismal failure, forced them to sign a peace treaty with the Habsburgs not long after that was really the first time the Ottomans ever signed a treaty at their disadvantage. And it was that was a big sign that things were not going well for the empire. At this point, by the late 18th century, I mean, you know, you're only 50 years away from the Crimean War. There's a lot of concern or growing concern at this point, I would say, among, say, you know, I mean, everybody's kind of focused, going to be focused on Napoleon shortly after this. And right now they're focused on the revolution, the French Revolution, and how do we prevent this from doing anything to us? But there are concerns, and they're going to get really serious in the next couple of decades, that Russia, for example, is going to swallow up the Ottoman Empire, and that's going to throw the whole balance of power out of whack, or that the Habsburgs are kind of, you know, have their own problems at this point, but there are concerns that the Habsburgs are going to be able to swallow up part of the Balkans, and that's going to upset the balance of power. So it's transitioning. The Ottoman Empire is transitioning, I think, from an entity that was a player in European power politics to kind of the object of European power politics. Instead of being a factor in its own right, the role that it's going to start playing, especially over the next couple of decades, is as the place where actual European powers kind of play around. They, you know, it's like a sandbox. They kind of try to chip away pieces of it. And meanwhile, the more distant European powers, France and Britain, are going to watch this happening and think, you know, this is not very good news for us. Britain in particular is going to worry because, you know, the Ottoman Empire sits in between Britain and India. And that's, you know, that's a huge concern for them.
Yeah, as Napoleon was well aware.
Right, exactly.
Last thing I wanted to touch on, I'm talking about Napoleon. We can't not talk about military stuff, right?
Right.
So what did these Middle Eastern armies look like, both the Ottomans and the Mamluks? You know, what was the military historians love this term, the way of war. So what was the Middle Eastern way of war in this era?
This is easier to talk about for the Ottomans because they were more militarily active than the Mamluks were. But the Ottoman military was based around, still at this point, mostly based around the Janissaries, who had, you know, in their day, in let's say late 15th, early to mid 16th centuries, had been maybe the preeminent fighting force in Europe. They were one of the first kind of professionalized armies. They were slave soldiers as well. They were conscripted from Christian populations in the Balkans. Boys from, you know, were taken from their families at very young ages. They were well trained and indoctrinated and converted to Islam. And they were one of the first kind of standing professional armies in Europe to adopt firearms. Ergo, you know, they became quite proficient at using them, and they were quite proficient at using field artillery. They had tactics that were very advanced in how to deploy those things effectively. And in a time when a lot of other armies were still using cavalry, these guys would set up behind their wagon fortresses and just pound the hell out of people, you know, out of cavalry running about on the battlefield. So for a long time, that was a very effective system for the Ottomans. What began to happen was the Janissaries began to amass, as soldiers tend to do when they're unchecked, and especially in this kind of slave system, they began to amass more political power. They began to own businesses where they were technically prohibited from doing that. They began to get married and have children, which technically when you were an active duty Janissary, you weren't allowed to do. Basically, they got very fat and happy off of the other peoples of the Ottoman Empire, and they stopped putting, you know, they stopped really wanting to fight so much. They had a lot of reasons to want to kind of stay home and manage their finances.
Who can blame them? Yeah.
And so, you know, they just kind of became bloated and ineffective. There were several efforts over the decades of the, you know, in the 18th and especially 19th century to do away with the Janissaries. None of these were effective until, I want to get the date right, until, right, 1826, finally, Sultan Mahmud II sent a new military force that he had built that was along European lines and, you know, trained in European tactics and drilled on European exercises, put them out on the streets of Istanbul and just told them to kill every Janissary they found, basically. I mean, he carted field artillery to the main Janissary headquarters and just blew it up.
Wow.
Basically, just massacred them. But up until then, you know, there were successive sultans who had seen this problem that the Janissaries weren't in top condition anymore. They weren't advanced. They were kind of lagging behind the Europeans. And so they tried to reform the military and create new forces that were based on Western models. But the Janissaries would always rebel. And they would do it quickly enough that the sultans hadn't had a chance to really get their reforms in place. And that would be the end of that. So for the Ottomans, it was mostly a case of stagnation and, you know, fighting 18th century wars with 16th or even 15th century tactics. The Mamluks, what we know of the Mamluks and the way that they fought largely comes from their response to Napoleon's invasion. And what that tells us is that they were even further, you know, they were really living in the past. These guys were primarily cavalry force, and they were, when they encountered Napoleon's armies, Napoleon's army, I mean, they just chewed the Mamluks up. They weren't really able to do much when they met Napoleon's army in the field. I think it's mostly because they were stuck in, you know, fighting two centuries old tactics against a modern European army.
So we're talking about like armies that are, you know, there's the core that's the standing army that's a social elite, like the Janissaries or the Mamluks, and then just like kind of militias?
Yeah, for the most part, you would see auxiliaries called up. The Ottomans had what are called sipahis, who were the land holders, like the aristocracy. That was their main cavalry force that became less and less important over time as the kind of the main functional aspect of the Ottoman military became really the Janissaries and the people with guns. But yeah, they had the cavalry levies, and then they had some conscription. This was not a very common thing for the Ottomans. I mentioned that they did it during the 13 Years' War with the Habsburgs, and it really went very pear-shaped for them because the conscripts took their guns and said thank you very much and then rebelled. So yeah, I mean they tended to use levies, but most of the levies that the Ottomans used would come from, or most of the auxiliaries that they would use would come from Balkan vassals. So the Serbs often lent soldiers to the Ottoman army, or you know, other Balkan vassals would participate. Wallachians would, whenever Wallachia was an Ottoman vassal, it went back and forth, obviously, many times over the centuries. But, you know, they would sometimes lend soldiers. For the Mamluks, you know, we don't hear much about any kind of levies of ordinary Egyptian Arabs. That was probably because they feared that if they arm these guys, they're going to turn on us and right, overthrow us. They did have, there were Bedouin. Now the word, even the word Arab, I guess at this time, I should be clear, typically is used to refer to Bedouin, not to the way we think of Arab as anybody who is ethnically Arab or speaks Arabic as a native language. Typically, the word was reserved for Bedouin, and Bedouin, we tend to think of nomads or people with a nomadic background. There were settled Bedouin who had recently identified a patch of land and decided to, this is ours now. They would often make themselves a nuisance as thieves, raiders, making life difficult for people. The road from Alexandria to Cairo, for example, was almost impassable. People had to go along the coast to Rosetta, and then from Rosetta upriver to Cairo. You couldn't go directly from Alexandria to Cairo because there were, you know, these kind of lawless gangs roaming around of Bedouin. They would sometimes be brought in as auxiliaries, whether to do, you know, actual fighting in actual battles. The Mamluks didn't fight a lot of actual battles, but they would often be brought in to do things like patrolling the desert for people trying to get around customs duties and get around customs posts by, you know, circumnavigating them. The Bedouin would be sent out. There's a funny story, actually, from Ibn Battuta, is a very famous Muslim traveler in the 14th century. There was one main customs post between Mamluk Syria and Mamluk Egypt, where people, all travelers, had to stop and kind of, you know, pay their duties and their taxes. And the way that the Mamluks tried to enforce this was they would send Bedouin out into the desert every night to brush the sand like flat. And then they would go out in the morning and look to see if there were any tracks of people trying to get around this place. I don't know how effective that was, but I assume, you know, he wasn't lying about this. So they served when they were brought in to do kind of state business. They served in those kind of auxiliary functions. But yeah, I mean, we don't hear about a lot of the auxiliary forces. You mostly hear about the Mamluk cavalry and their usually unsuccessful exploits, especially around this time.
So, I mean, really, we're talking about here, you know, the ruler has people he can call upon to furnish him troops, which is really more of almost like a feudal arrangement than it is a modern army.
Yeah, I think it's more akin to that. There are, it's never a great one-to-one match to talk about feudalism in the Islamic context. There are things that are unique to that society that, you know, it's not a perfect comparison. But I think certainly if you're, you know, if you've got a continuum between the old style feudal army and the modern professional European military, what the Mamluks have going on is far closer to the feudal system.
Mm. As far as tactics of these armies, really, we're talking about cavalry charges.
Yes.
And that's kind of it, right?
Yes. And that's why they really don't do very well against Napoleon.
Yeah, the Europeans cracked that code a while ago.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They'd figured this out by then. And I think it's another kind of indicative sign of how little the Egyptians thought about or had any contact with Europe, that this army showed up and they, you know, started running waves of cavalry at it to just get gunned down.
Well, to them, I mean, most of the fighting these guys were doing was sort of, you know, like you said, these factional struggles, right? So, you know, riding around on a horse with a sword, if you're just kind of fighting another couple hundred guys who are similarly equipped, that's a perfectly fine way to go about it, right? I mean, they didn't really fight wars on a grand scale like Europeans did. Or even the Ottomans.
Right. I mean, the Mamluk military heyday was back, you know, when they were fighting the Mongols, when they were fighting the Crusaders. So that was centuries earlier when that kind of tactic was fine for full-on military engagement. But after that, you're right, most of the violence that the typical Mamluk would engage in his lifetime would have been, you know, me and a few dozen of my cohort are going to go out and fight another cohort, and whoever wins gets to appoint the next sultan or something like that, or the next Sheikh al-Balad. It was organized mob violence. It was, you know, more than it was actual military, military thing.
Well, that's all I have. Is there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think, you know, that's cool. If I've answered your questions, I'm happy with that.
Oh yeah. Answered all my questions and more. That was very illuminating. Thank you.
Sure.
Well, thanks for coming. If you want to hear more from Derek Davison, he writes regularly at Loeblog. That's LOBE log.com. He also runs two sites of his own. The first is therila.com, which provides a running commentary on the journals of Ibn Battuta, the great medieval Arab explorer and adventurer. That story from the interview about the Bedouins sweeping the sand to catch smugglers comes from Ibn Battuta. If you found it interesting, there's more where that came from. That's therila.com. therihlah.com. The second website is And That's the Way It Was. There you'll find articles and a podcast that covers world history and international affairs. Derek and the other writers reliably bring the proper context and nuance. I highly recommend it. You can find it at attiw.com. That's just the initials of And That's the Way It Was. I'll put links to all three sites in the episode description for anyone who missed them. Well, that's it for now. For those of you who observe the holiday, Merry Christmas from the Age of Napoleon. For the rest of you, it will be Quintidi, the 5th of Nivose, year 227 of the Republic, on the Jacobin calendar, which is the day of the dog, so that's not bad either. To everyone, have a happy new year. I'm grateful for all the support that helped make the show successful in 2018. If you've contributed financially, recommended us to a friend, shared us on social media, or sent me some word of encouragement or bit of information, thank you. And here's to another year of Napoleon. That's all for now. As always, thanks for listening.
Hello, this is Matt from the Explorers Podcast. I want to invite you to join me on the voyages and journeys of the most famous explorers in the history of the world. These are the thrilling and captivating stories of Magellan, Shackleton, Lewis and Clark, and so many other famous and not so famous adventurers from throughout history. Go to explorerspodcast.com or just look us up on your podcast app. That's the Explorers Podcast.